Good morning, my name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and my high school English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, talk to interesting people from around the area about their life experiences and how those life experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today. He's back this week.
So we're here today with Jennifer Crockett, the executive director of the Liberty Theater. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Before the show, we talked a little bit about what brought you to Astoria and brought you to this job and all the things that kind of led up to this point. And we talked about your past playing clarinet and playing music. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into clarinet, the level at which you kind of studied it, and tell us about your background with that?
Sure. I started clarinet when I was 10. I knew that my mom had played clarinet, my grandmother had played clarinet. I really wanted to play cello, but I was given a clarinet. And I played all the way through public school for elementary and for middle school. And then in high school, I was recruited into Interlochen, a school for the arts. I went back to public school my senior year, but by that point, I knew that I wanted to play it for a living. I went on to DePaul University in the clarinet school, graduated from there, and then stayed for graduate school there as well, and then went out on the audition circuit.
Did you know when you started playing clarinet pretty quickly that, oh, I have a gift, and this is coming easily to me, and people are commenting on it? And
yeah, I don't know that I knew that I had a gift as much as I really loved it. I struggled in school. I had a sleep disorder. I really had a hard time with memory and with classes. I, outside of music, had a pretty hard time. But in the band program, I had an active social life. I was playing in a bunch of different ensembles. I was in marching band. I was pep band. I did everything. I absolutely loved it. And even when the pressure started to get higher when I was in art programs like, you know, Interlochen and at DePaul, I didn't necessarily see it as stress. I liked the challenge. So I was really drawn to it.
Would you say that over time, you know, that sort of like these high stakes moments and the challenge of it, it evolved into, you know, it was taxing, it was stressful. The challenge aspect kind of slipped away and got obscured by the stress, would you say? And like, how did that happen?
Yeah, it didn't really get stressful until I was out of school and taking auditions. I auditioned for a bunch of major symphonies. I had spent my entire life training for this one job that at that time in the early 2000s, there weren't many symphonies that had openings. Players tend to make a symphony and they will stay with it until they're of advanced age. I've heard it equated to, I mean, you have a less than 3% chance after school of making a major symphony as a wind player because there are only two of you in the orchestra, that my chances would have been better trying for an Olympic sport. But so it didn't really get stressful until I started auditioning and was told no over and over and over and over again. And nothing in my career had prepared me for that. I ended up on my last audition. I was in a hotel room outside of Seattle, and I just absolutely called my mom and said, I never want to see this thing ever again. I flew home and I shipped her my clarinet and said, I'm done. And I quit for 10 years.
Wow. Did it feel liberating that next morning after that phone call, or did you second guess yourself? Was it just immediate relief?
I think I felt immediately relieved until about 10 years later, a friend of mine moved to, I was living in Portland at the time, and a friend of mine moved to Portland and kind of outed me at a party saying, did you know that Jen went to school for clarinet? I had not told anyone that knew me that I went to school for clarinet. And there were times throughout those 10 years, I couldn't see the symphony. I couldn't see A film that had a clarinet solo in it. It was overwhelming emotionally. I regretted playing or quitting, but I didn't know how to get back to it. I sort of equate it to, it was like I moved to Portland with my arm amputated and none of my friends knew me with two arms. But so when I started playing again, I did it very slowly. I started taking with a teacher that was a practicing Buddhist, and we worked on playing mindfully and without shame. I think a lot of adult players, when they pick up their instrument after decades, they remember how they used to play and they feel bad that they don't do that anymore. So we worked a lot on, this is how I play today. This is how I sound now. I started very slowly. I played with the Portland Gay Symphonic Band. They were super welcoming. They play at all different levels. I really enjoyed that. I started playing in chamber music again. I'm incapable of enjoying anything as a mere hobby, so I basically threw myself back in and starting auditioning for symphonies, and I currently play with two orchestras and I have an active chamber career.
So it's almost like you're busier now with clarinet than you were when you were auditioning, you know, however many years ago.
Totally.
Right?
Like, well, and I think I enjoy it now, too. Yeah. I think so much of my lessons with my Buddhist teacher were just enjoy the feeling of your air going through this instrument and the vibration it creates, and enjoy how your tone, you know, fills a room. It was so minutiae that a lot of that is beaten out of you in music conservatory. You feel like you're chasing that brass ring constantly. You're never allowed to just sit and enjoy your playing.
What was the process like for this teacher to get you to do this consistently? Like in the beginning, was it like, oh, crap, I'm doing that thing again?
And then, totally.
And then he's reminding you. And
almost every lesson ended in tears. I would get super frustrated. I'd play a wrong note and immediately apologize. And that is a highly trained musician thing. The first thing out of your mouth is, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So we had to undo a lot of that. Now, you know, you can see the humor in a mistake or you can see the humanness in a mistake. I really enjoy listening to recordings of amazing musicians where I know I just heard a flub 99% of the world would
can't
not hear,
yeah.
But that makes it sound really human to me. So much of our music these days is processed that you don't hear those little gems that, you know, make you unique. So I really enjoy that. And I've learned to enjoy that in my playing as well.
What are some things that, being a musician myself, I'm curious what you find in music that you think most other people wouldn't notice? The average listener, somebody who's never even picked up an instrument or played a piece of music, what are some things that you think get missed a lot?
I think the emotion of a piece. I really enjoy when you do hear a player that is genuinely having fun. I think just like so much of our music being processed, I think so much of playing classical music is trying to strive for perfection, and I think you lose a lot of emotion in that. So when I hear a player that maybe their technique isn't perfect, maybe their pitch isn't perfect, but they are really loving what they're playing, that is 10 times more valuable to me as a listener than something that is executed perfectly.
Is when you play now, has it become kind of intuitive, this sort of mindset that your instructor kind of helped you see? Do you just shift into that now? And you know, if you make a mistake, is it immediate where you say, oh, no, don't fixate on that. Just keep going. And
yeah,
you know, what is that process like now?
Yeah. Now I can move on more quickly. I think it's probably a lot like a gymnast. If you make a mistake and then you sort of see, you know, when you're watching the Olympics and you see this, or an ice skater, the ice skater falls and then their entire rest of the performance is shaky. They're having a really hard time getting past that mistake. And you can hear that with players where it's almost like a house of cards. They make a mistake. There's a lot of shame around it. their nerves suddenly peak, their adrenaline goes way up, they can't recover from it. I mean, I'm not perfect. I'm still, when I play with the symphony, if I make a giant goose egg, it's hard to recover from that for anyone. But you can kind of, you can lean into that mistake. You can make it sound like it's not a mistake. It was a little more intentional. Mm-hmm. You very much have to brush it off and just sort of take a deep breath and keep going through. And so,
if you had to put your finger on what it is about, the way adults play music and how they lose this quality that they had when they were kids, where there was this playfulness, you know, you mentioned earlier, like, you know, if you're a kid, you think nothing of like playing Celine Dion songs on your clarinet and just trying to cover whatever you want. And what makes that go away as people get deeper and deeper into maybe not just music, anything?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's that same thing of, you know, there's that cliche of women always lamenting that they don't fit into their jeans from college anymore, or, you know, that like you can't throw a football like you used to. I think it's that same thing with music. You have this idea of how you played at this one point in time back when you had way more time. Maybe you didn't have kids. Maybe you weren't working full time. You could play as much as you want. And now you're coming back as an adult with, you have a family to take care of, you have laundry to do, you have a full-time job. You don't have that unlimited time. But I think where people sell themselves short is you have a lot of life experience that you can now put into your playing that you didn't have when you were 16. I think I'm a very different player than I was, even at my peak when I was auditioning. I can feel the difference in my playing now. I'm a lot more relaxed. I'm a lot less judgmental of myself. I really enjoy my instrument, whereas before I was doing that thing that I thought I was supposed to do and clinging on as hard as I could. And that doesn't make you a better player. So I feel like now I'm a better player as an adult than I was at that age.
This is kind of leading me into, I'm thinking about, you know, how all of this playing and all of this experience has kind of set you up for this kind of awesome gig that you now have. You mentioned before the show that you feel like all of these years of playing music, it's made you feel comfortable around directness and, you know, receiving direct feedback, giving direct feedback, because there's no way to sugarcoat somebody saying, well, that's kind of off key. Can you do, you know, it either is or is not, right? So, can you talk a little bit about that? You know, how has your past playing music kind of set you up really nicely for this current position that you have as executive director?
Yeah, I think definitely around directness and feedback. I know when I was working in retail and I was managing stores and managing staff, it is a hard skill to learn to give feedback unemotionally in the moment and directly. And that is something that you learn along the way when you're taking lessons in music or playing in an ensemble. Having your band director say, you're a little bit sharp, can you bring your pitch down? Doesn't mean, I think you're a terrible player, you should probably quit. It just means you're a little sharp, can you bring your pitch down? And I think, and even as musicians, turning to the person next to you and saying, you're rushing that, you're playing a little too fast, can you slow that down? We're able to do that in an ensemble setting without emotion. And that has really served me well throughout management is I can say, you were 5 minutes late today. Please don't be late tomorrow. And it doesn't mean you're a terrible employee. Otherwise, it just means don't be late tomorrow. I also think playing in music, you are one of a team. You, even though you may be a soloist for a few minutes or a soloist for a piece, you are rarely not part of a team. And so it has made me aware that I need to surround myself with people that are more skilled than I am. Like we were talking about, I have never renovated a theater before. I have no idea how to renovate a theater. So I surrounded myself with people at the theater that have this experience and know how this works. And Coming into a nonprofit job, I had never fundraised before. So I've surrounded myself with people that have done that or have great insights or are willing to help.
That sounds really overwhelming.
Overwhelming.
How do you manage the, I'm just trying to think of like, okay, if I try to do this thing that I've never done before and it's directly tied to my livelihood and, you know, how do you manage the stress that must come with that to some degree?
Yeah. I find the people that can help me. Yeah. So that has served me very well at the theater is, if I don't know how to do something, I find someone that does and ask for help. It's my favorite saying around fundraising is if you need money, ask for advice, because if you ask for money, all you'll get is advice. And it's the same in almost every task. If you need help with something, ask for advice, and 9 times out of 10, that person will help you do it. I've really held on to that throughout my time theater.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had the opportunity November, December to come on to the Liberties Board as the youth advisory member. And I can say from serving on a couple different boards in this town that the Liberties Board is one of the most energetic and knowledgeable boards that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
They do the work, whereas other boards will tell you to do the work.
Right.
And they're put together of people with such diverse knowledges. I mean, architects, lawyers, financial officers, they all serve a different piece of a puzzle. And I think that is testament to the fact that you can put together a team very well, a lot better than I think I've seen at other boards.
Yeah, we have a great board. And I think, too, I'm a little biased because we have such a great story. This theater has been here for 95 years. It has touched everyone in this community. Everyone wants to see it thrive. My role as executive director, I feel like, is to facilitate that. I put together a team. I guide the process, but it is not about me. It is, I try to be a jack of all trades. I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I don't know everything. And acknowledging that has really contributed to our success. Finding those people that are experienced and are committed really serves us well.
Could you talk a little bit more about how the fundraising has been going and what you've learned from this process? You said earlier that, you know, you didn't know about all this fundraising stuff before and you've had to kind of teach yourself. And so what have some of the takeaways been so far?
Well, we are just under 50% of the way through our $3.5 million goal in 12 months. I knew going into this that we have a community that really supports the Liberty. What I didn't know was that we would have a community that really supports this project and really wants to see the Liberty grow into a destination for tourism and also more of an anchor within our community. I feel like I have a really skewed idea of how a capital campaign goes. I know it's supposed to be harder than this, and I anticipate that the second half of fundraising is going to be a lot harder. I've been really blown away at the generosity of people around us. Like I said, I knew that people love the theater. Everyone has either been married there or had a date there or their family has worked there. But I didn't know that this project would have such community support.
Do you feel like the capital campaign has inspired people who have never volunteered before or have not been as actively involved in Liberty to get more involved? Like it's like growing your volunteer base just through
Absolutely.
The capital campaign?
Or? Well, and I think even just in the 3 years that I've been there, we've worked really hard at shedding that elite Liberty persona. I think, we weren't open terribly often, and the events that we were doing spoke to a small slice of the community. We were seen as a little unfriendly and somewhere that people were a little bit uncomfortable. we've worked really, really hard at turning that on its head. We had a Tom Petty cover band last night. Everyone had a fantastic time. We have tribute bands. We have community groups. We have high school bands. We have classical music. We have theater. We open our doors to everything. We've also worked really hard at making sure that our volunteer base is an accurate representation of the community around us. We have gone from about 40 volunteers to almost 100 volunteers fulfilling different roles. Our volunteers have gotten more age diverse, more gender diverse, racially diverse, demographically diverse. And I think that that has also contributed to our audience growing as well. When you see someone like you being an usher, you feel more comfortable in that space. So it's been working out really well.
Wow.
And I know that one of the things with capital campaigns is that you guys forget about operations sometimes. People can actually forget about their operations. And it becomes a little bit tougher to run a theater while you're going out for $3.5 million. So what has it been like in your 3 years there actually getting people into the doors as far as compared to maybe the past? Or what kinds of events do you think have been particularly influential to getting a new demographic inside the building?
I think having a lot of, we try to do at least one free show a month. This area has a wide spread of incomes. A lot of people struggle to afford the places that they live, and we definitely, I understand that at the theater, and we want to make sure that we're not making art inaccessible for this area. So the one free show a month at bare minimum has really grown our audience. I think if you come and there's no barrier financially to coming into the theater, you have a great time. Chances are you will come to another event. You will come to more events. And making sure that those free shows aren't, you know, patronizing to people too. They're still great shows. They just are free. That will bring people back in. I think having more family-oriented programming. There are a lot of families in this area, so our programming tries to reflect the area as well. Lots of people like country music. We're bringing in country band in April, and all the tribute bands. I think a lot of people would snub their noses at that, but you know what? Art is also about having fun. It can't be always educational or, you know, or highbrow. I think we just try to be as open to the community as we possibly can.
Is there anything looking ahead to the next kind of month or so that people should keep on their radar for the Liberty? I mean, anything you want to kind of plug and let people know about?
We do a lot of film in January. We don't typically do well with film. There are other great film theaters in this area that do such a fantastic job that I don't tend to be as risky with that. But right now, people really like dressing up and people really like singing along. So we're doing a lot of sing-alongs and costume films.
Cool.
And again, that goes with just having fun. The Liberty is a very, very special place, but you can be very special without being elite. Sometimes it's great to just kick your heels off and put on a crazy costume and sing along to your favorite film. And I love that. And January is the perfect time to do it when it's really, gross. Really and crazy outside. As long as our power doesn't go out, it's great.
That has happened, right?
That has happened.
If anybody is listening and wants to help with the capital campaign, what should they do? Where should they go?
Go to our website. It's libertyastoria.org. And there's a contact page or there's a support page. You can reach out. And helping with our capital campaign means everything from the obvious donations to helping with your time, helping us with ushering, volunteering in our office. We have a steering committee that's helping with fundraising. We've got a board of directors. There's a bunch of different things you can do at the theater.
Cool. I don't think we covered what are some of like the four or five kind of biggest renovations that are covered by the capital campaign. Like this money is going toward what specifically?
It is The Capital Campaign's goal is to expand the infrastructure at the Liberty to widen our programming. The first step of this is increasing our visibility and also some customer service issues, addressing some. We are renovating the front vestibule so that it's more lit. We'll have poster cases. We look like we're open. Our box office is flipping around to the inside of the vestibule so that patrons don't have to wait in the rain for their tickets. It's just a better customer service model. We're building a new concession stand. Industry standard tells me that concessions should be 9%, 9% of your operating budget. It's currently 2.5% of our operating budget. We are leaving about $60,000 on the table every year by not having a real concession stand. That helps our operating budget. We're also making the theater a lot more energy efficient to help our operating budget. And then the major portion of this campaign is our stage and our backstage areas. We were built as a vaudeville theater that quickly converted to film. So we don't have rigging, curtains, lighting, dressing rooms, loading areas that most theaters have. And it makes it so we really only rely on live music for programming. We can't hang any scenery. We struggle with housing more than a handful of performers. But this changes all of that. And that increases not only the wide range of programming we can offer, it increases our economic impact to our downtown. It creates jobs. It is more of an economic driver for the theater. It touches on a lot. The renovation does a lot of different things, but it's really going to put the Liberty in a completely different place.
It's so cool. It feels like there's already this kind of energy and this momentum building, and I just can't even imagine once all of this is done, you know, kind of where it's going to be at and how it's going to feel.
I'm going to sleep.
It's so cool. Yeah. You know, as you were describing that, I was like, oh man, there's probably a whole slew of show types that now we'll be able to have.
Oh,
there.
Absolutely. You aren't seeing the full production like we want to show it. We do what we can, and it costs us a little bit more because we don't get a discount on that. So we still have to charge the ticket price. It still is a hardship on our theater while we try to be creative to give the illusion that you're seeing the whole production, but you're really not. And once we have this renovation done, we will be a standard truck theater. We'll be able to do Broadway style productions like Rent, like Wizard of Oz, like Fiddler on the Roof, like Hairspray. We've met with booking agents. They're really excited that the Liberty is on the coast between Portland and Seattle. We're a perfect stopping point. We'll be able to get a lot of shows, a really wide array of staged opera, fully staged dance productions, things that we're not currently able to do.
So cool. Jennifer Crockett, thank you so much for coming on. It was great hearing about all of these things about your past with music and what's going on with Liberty. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time.
So this is the part of the show where I offer my student perspective on our in-studio guest today. One of the things that I've come to appreciate about Jennifer Crockett is her ability to put together a great team. Having worked with the Liberty's board, I know that the people in that room are some of the most knowledgeable about the certain aspects which they are experts in. And when Jennifer says that she's the least knowledgeable in the room, she means it in the best way possible. By allowing those people to take the lead on the specific areas which they have interest in, it makes the group better as a whole. And I think that that's something that we should take away from Jennifer's leadership strategy, because obviously it's working really well for the Liberty as of right now. If somebody else can say it better, you should quote them. And that kind of mindset trickles into our leadership style. If somebody else can lead better, you should put them in charge of that committee or that team. But beyond that, Jennifer showed us the dangers of becoming too specialized. We should allow ourselves the time to develop our interests and our skills and maybe our talents that we didn't know we had before, because they can show us a new side of ourselves that we've never seen before. Sometimes picking up a new hobby can be exactly what we need for a boost of new creativity or maybe just a little bit more inspiration. So I would say, and I think Jennifer would agree with me, always give yourself the time to develop new skills or maybe try something that you had never done before. It can mean all the difference.